Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another reality show. I'm your host, Golden Hawk, and we have another amazing show. This is actually a part two show, and I don't want to call it a part two as much as a continuing conversation of, you know, really amazing qualities that are being experienced right now, whether they be experienced in the resistance or whether they be in the flow and creating miracles. There is definitely shifting happening on our planet right now, and I have two, you know, in my personal opinion, experts on the wisdom for what is happening right now, and so I'm really excited to get tonight's show started. So let's get everybody introduced. Tonight I have Robert Sabella, who is an astrological and intuitive consultant. He's a metaphysician, a teacher. He's known and celebrated for his uniquely mystical approach to guidance. He emphasizes the need for each of us to cultivate holistic clarity and to heal as the primary devotion and priority in our lives. I am honored and delighted to have you back with us, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Goldie. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, awesome. And our second panel guest, to the honorable and distinctive Daniel Jacobs, who is a channeler and a healer, and, you know, just an all-around truly amazing man. I'm so delighted our paths crossed a few years ago, and I get to call Daniel my friend. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Thank you. I really appreciate the honorable part. I think I just got elected to a city judgeship or something. But I promise not to be too judgmental. How's that?
You just be Daniel, and I know I'll giggle. As long as I'm giggling, I'm happy tonight.
So glad to be here.
I just want to kind of get a wrap about what we started last show, because I was listening to it. You know, we really rocked. Just so everybody knows, January 7th, there's an archive of me, Robert, and Daniel, you know, opening up the topic of the blending and the coming together of the masculine and feminine. And what I think is actually happening in a broader spectrum is all opposites seem to be coming into our experience to be embraced and understood and integrated. So we were talking about many things, how it shows up in relationships, how it shows up in belief systems and gender expectations. And we're just going to pretty much continue on from that. I think it's clear to everybody between earthquakes, tsunamis, whether it be on the planet or in our personal lives, things are happening, things are moving, and, you know, I would imagine it's bringing up a curiosity at the very least and, you know, a deep-seated, I need to know what is going on at the very most, because there is so much shifting happening right now. You know, and everybody chime in as they do, but I guess, Robert, you wanted to maybe open up with Mars, because Mars energy clearly seems to be combative, and I guess combative is definitely one of the elements that we're seeing, you know, prevalent in these days and hours.
You know, Mars energy is a piece of it, Goldie. It's never just a singular planetary force or a celestial force. But, you know, we've been in a Mars retrograde period. And Mars, typically was the, archetypally was the energy behind war. And so it moves a lot of energy. And Mars is stationary right now, so it's holding the culmination of the retrograde energies that have been harvested since December 20th when it went retrograde. So it's a very intense period, and if you look around and you interact with people, and I know you do, you'll feel this energy in them. It's poised to take action when Mars goes direct. In another way, the planet body has been taking on new light, new consciousness, new energy. And so there's a great shifting going on within the planet itself. And, you know, this can manifest as earthquakes and, other environmental things as well. So it's a very intense period. And we in our own physical bodies carry this energy, the Mars energy, which is related to physicality. And so it's been challenging because the the consciousness that's driving this is so much faster than what the body can receive, what it's used to receiving. And so the pacing is way off. We've never done this before. It's never happened at this pace, at this acceleration. So this is what we're trying to hold and anchor and ultimately integrate. It's very challenging.
Very challenging. And it's real easy for us to slip into adversarial roles, even though we understand on a mental basis that it's all us and that we're only, whenever we're offended by something, it has to do with something inside us. When we're gratified by something, it has something to do with inside us. But for a moment, like you might say, a silly little moment of forgetfulness, we can easily slip into an adversarial thing, which isn't always bad. I mean, we learn some great lessons through that. Eventually, when we wake back up and go, oh, by the way, it's all me. Oh, okay, I get it. You know,
it's very easy to slip into that, Daniel, because, this Mars energy is related more to our animal nature.
Yeah.
It's a primordial instinct, and it's very easy to trigger it on a level that's below consciousness.
Yeah. And so when that happens, it's real easy for a person to think perhaps we failed, you know, because we just thought we understood every bit what was going on, and yet that's what we have in our mind. But we forget that the subconscious connections for the emotional parts of us and the physical parts of us are they're wired on such a hair trigger kind of a way that the mind can't move fast enough to be able to completely deliberate or negotiate how it's going to go off. So just like when we touch a hot stove and our hand immediately jerks back, it's the same thing. When we touch something that is a hot trigger for us, yeah, before we know it, we're into it and we're up to our neck in crocodiles and then we wonder how we got there. But it's actually being knocked out of our control space is one of the best learning experiences we can have, because then we can see what's behind the facades and what's behind all the efforts we make to deceive or to perhaps play act that being something. We get a chance to see what we really are on some of those levels, and that can be helpful.
Energetically, isn't there momentum involved in, you know, kind of breaking out of old paradigms through the anger that gets us there?
Yep. Yeah, it's like pushing off from a swimmer's wall, you know. You get a chance to push off, and you can go halfway across the pool with that momentum that happens just through that knee-jerk reaction, and maybe you'll make some progress that you wouldn't normally do if you were in a calmer state of mind, so.
Right.
This is true, Goldie. And the practice here, the practice of integrating this energy, is to entrain the consciousness to intervene with that reaction that Daniel articulated. So it takes practice to be able to intervene with something that's happening that quickly and on such a subconscious level. And, I mean, we're being prompted to go into higher levels of mastery here so that we can have dominion over this energy rather than having it have dominion over us.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. And that's powerful space. I mean, it's going to take some powerful changes to get us to a powerful space.
Commitment.
And even if we can't have dominion over it, if we can at least laugh and enjoy the ride, that's a kind of dominion, too.
It actually is, because it describes detachment, and if you're in a healthy detached place, you are in a way in dominion.
Yeah, if you're the watcher self, you know, you're sitting up on the wall eating an apple, going, "Wow, I'm watching myself go through this. What a kick!" You know,
indeed.
And that's something.
A friend of mine who is, because I am definitely feeling a lot of relationship. I'm not in a one-on-one per se, but a lot of my friends that are, there are two very familiar things I'm hearing from them, and these are like totally unrelated people per se other than me. And one of that is that there seems to be a truth-revealing time that's happening right now, like these tremendous lies of, like, one of my friends had a lie, the whole identification that her boyfriend was presenting to her came up. He was nothing that he said he was. You know, he wasn't a military person. He wasn't married at one point. Like, Even she said to me, like, lies that didn't necessarily make him look better. She didn't even know why he lied about it. But, and another girlfriend of mine had a boyfriend who she found out was having a relationship completely unbeknownst to her. But, like, the threat is the lying is and the truth that is surfacing. And what both of them are doing is they're getting angry, but, like, one of them wrote a letter to herself first to express the anger, and then wrote him the letter to express that, it, you know, I guess he was kind of writing her letters going, are we done? And she was like, yeah, we're pretty much done.
know, well, it's a Tiger Woods kind of moment there. At that point in time, it's a Tiger Woods, you know, and everybody, he has become so symbolic of all of a sudden this false facade falls down and behind it. It's not just a little old man behind the screen, but it's a whole bunch of different old men behind the screen and dirty old man, I guess. I don't know, whatever they call it. But,
well, I think, you know, Goldie, I agree with you that, you know, what you've become aware of in the way of relationships is a very heightened environment right now.
Yeah.
I've been watching it in my own practice with my own clients. You know, it's just come up with alarming regularity in my own life as well. And, you know, what we have here, if I could make another astrological reference, I don't like to...
Please.
I don't
spend
too much time waxing astrologically because it can oftentimes distance people. But we're in the, you know, Neptune, which is this force that represents deception and illusion and lack of clarity and disorientation. It's also related to our willingness to be deceived as well.
Yeah, that's a good point right there.
That's a very good point.
That's the flip side of it, isn't it?
Yeah. It's the generating point for the deception itself is our
willingness
to deceive, because this is all happening, as you know, through projection.
Well, I have a man crush on you, Robert. It's brilliant. Please don't let me interrupt. That's brilliant.
Okay, so with what we have here is Neptune in the very last few degrees of Aquarius, along with Chiron. And these two forces haven't been together since 1945.
Oh.
And what's going on here is exactly what you described. It's this thing that's you know, basically purging us of anything that is not of truth. And it seems to be playing out in the realm of relationships more than any other place right now. And so there's a lot of revelation going on, a lot of exposing, and it's been challenging as a result of it, because when we are all of a sudden exposed to, you know, the dynamics that have been going on, like in these examples that you gave, it can be, well, first of all, very painful, and it can throw us into a tailspin, because our whole orientation in trust has been overturned.
Yeah.
But this is what's going on right now, and it's enormously powerful.
And
yeah.
Particularly coming out, too, amongst the national leaders. When we have national leaders, governors, senators, and people
mm-hmm.
who are supposedly trustworthy in that way, to have them have their little affairs and their little divorces and their little things going on, it just kind of amplifies the whole thing. Not that they're not human. Nobody ever said they weren't human, but there was some degree of implication there that they should be better than human. And
right.
Sooner or later, we're going to get over that as a nation. We're just infants, really. When Europe looks at us, I'm sure they laugh a lot about all this stuff. But we're still trying to work our way through what we call morality, because on one hand, we wag our fingers at certain people, even national leaders, but we buy
mm-hmm.
up those magazines and those newspapers that tell us about it. Boy, we want to hear every squeaky detail. And that's kind of a hypocrisy, isn't it? You know, on one hand, you say, this is something I don't want in my life, and by the way, will you tell me all the juicy details? You know?
The gossip archetype lives in America, definitely.
Well, you know, we're all guilty of this to one extent or another, and the problem here, especially... especially in North America, is the cover-up. With the reference that you're making to Europe is that they don't spend as much time covering up these things.
Yeah.
And it's the truth. It's the truth. They've been doing this for a lot longer, and they understand what a waste of energy that is. The other, you know, that's connected to a bigger reality, which is that there are no lies in the universe. You know, we think that we can misrepresent and hide and disguise and throw a veil over something, but it literally doesn't happen. And energetically, when two people are communicating with each other, they know the full truth. Energetically, their bodies resonate with the full truth. Now, whether or not their brain or consciousness does, that's another story.
Yeah, the mind can lie or can be lied to, but the body picks up all the vibes and the emotions to a sense, too. And that's why it's so important to get a consensus among all three of those parts of us instead of just following one or letting one win out. Because, you have all these wheels on a car, but you only drive on one, you know. That,
right.
There's no reason for that. We need to get our consensus among our senses. And let all of them give feedback to us so that we can be adequately informed and not walking around in our sleepy dream.
Well, it
That's
seems like the
Daniel.
Dream is
yeah.
the dream itself is waking us up. You know, it's not like there's choice anymore. It's almost like, you know, live transparently or be exposed that you're not. Those are your choices. It's not like, oh, do I lie? Do I tell the truth? Well, no. It almost feels like there's an inevitability that because like telepathy is becoming a part of this experience.
Yes, it is.
Where that's when there's no lying because you're literally directly in communication without speech.
It's true. Yeah. As we move towards 2012 and the veil between three dimensions and the fourth dimension or the multi-dimensional reality gets thinner and thinner. This is the case. And so, you know, what we're talking about here is our willingness to be accountable. So we can't hide behind these things any longer. So I think you're right, Goldie, in the sense that it almost feels like we have no choice because the purging effect that's going on right now seems to be so comprehensive and so deep. And so we have to start to practice to be, you know, around being accountable. And again, this is not about judgment around anything we've done. The instinct to cover it up is the judgment itself. So we are the ones who are actually judging ourselves.
Yeah.
That's why it was so popular in the movie Avatar when they have that greeting that says, I see you. There's so much to that. You know, there's so much that there are people that are writing me and saying, I want to go and live there. How do we get on that ship? I want to go.
Me too! I was thinking the same. I saw the movie three times. To be there. It was such an exquisite, that tree, the soul tree, oh, God, just tickled my innards. I want to be there.
So when we talk about relationships, when we talk about our relationship to the earth, when we talk about our relationship to children, when we talk our relationship to animals, when we talk about our relationships to space and time and all these elements, it's so very, very important to be able to make the next adjustment, to make the next leap out of separateness and into this area of integration and wholeness as each other, so that we can, like you say, stop wasting energy trying to hide what's not even important in the first place. If we can get past that whole business about trying to project something or please someone else with who we are or aren't, and then just move on to the next thing, which is what do you want? What are you looking for? What do you crave? And how do we get there? And how can we work together to make that happen? Once we're over that hump, then we've got a whole lot of humps ahead of us. That's for sure.
Well, I
you guys
feel like
don't even say anything about my languaging.
It's all good. It's
we'll
all
save
good.
That for the sex segment.
That'll be
the third installment of this
show. Remember, Daniel, that would be the after midnight version of the show.
I'd walk a mile for a camel, you know. one hump or two.
Well, you know, okay, but well, because Robert, I just want to ask this because I think this is your field of expertise. Can you share anything on how to help people get to the space Daniel was just speaking about?
Well, that's a really good question, you know, and, you know, it would be hard for me to articulate a simple or formulaic answer to that.
Okay, I under that.
You know, it's true. The place to start is to investigate the instinct, for instance, to formulate a particular presentation for another person, for instance, if we're talking about interpersonal dynamics here. So why would we do that, you know, in the first place? It's very deeply ingrained. We've been doing it since we started breathing, really, and it's to get love, it's to get approval, and you know we go into this this tendency to start to amend things and sculpt them, and we do it very quickly. We do it very efficiently, and we fine tune it to each individual as well. So that we know we'll get the approval and love that we're seeking. Because if we were to tell the quote-unquote truth, we might be rejected. We might be abandoned. I feel like this is behind a lot of it, really.
Okay.
So we have to
check
in.
It goes all the way back to childhood, you know, and the vulnerability and dependency and all those things that where it all begins.
It's true. And we become masters of this. As we move along the time axis and live our lives and encounter more and more people and learn that we can actually get away with that. So there's that part of us that is always on the stage, you know, doing that performance, jumping through the hoops, and we don't even know why we're doing it ultimately. But if you look deeply, it's that, you know, oh, I don't know, I don't want to upset that person or I don't want to tell them something that might be difficult for them to hear. That's a smokescreen. What we really don't want is to be rejected and abandoned by that person for what we have done or what we think.
To be cut off from the love supply, you know, because we're
cut off from the
love
supply. We don't want to be cut off from the love supply ever.
For that love. And you had some great things.
I think it's important to
say.
I think it's important to find love from sources maybe not necessarily attached to people.
Okay.
I mean, like for me, I find my love in nature. You know, when I go to nature, I literally realize that my significant other right now is the woods. when I'm sad, I go to nature. Nature makes me feel better. When I'm lonely, I go to nature. Nature helps me feel loved. And then, see, once I come home from nature, now dealing with people, instead of needing something from that person, I'm filled. Now I can just share with that person instead of having them to make me whole. I kind of found my wholeness already, and I personally, that was what my breakthrough was. It was like, you know, I mean, truly as big as the Jews being released from Egypt, because all of a sudden it hit me that I never have to experience being lonely again. I mean, like deep lonely, you know, that painful lonely, which I lived most of my life being deeply lonely.
You're actually describing a lot of what was described by Alfred Kinsey in the beginning of his life story. That was one of the elements for him, was he developed his most intimate love of source with nature. And because he lived in a house where there was lots of repression and there was lots of harshness and no tenderness, no sense of safety, he found all of that out in nature, and you know, he would draw pictures of birds and he would categorize things, and yeah, it was his ability to categorize and do statistics that got him going before he wrote all of the groundbreaking sexuality books that he did back in the 50s that gave birth to the revolution of the 60s.
Oh, interesting.
He was a lover of nature, and then all of a sudden he began to discover the nature of love through that.
Exactly. Oh, awesomely stated. That's what's happening to me, and
it
brings a joy that I've never experienced before. Where like a lot of people are in a space where they're collapsing, I'm rising up. It's like, oh, he'll figure out. I'm never with the grain. I'm always against the grain.
What your instinct there is, Goldie, is a form of what I like to term self-bonding. When you can go into nature and feel that connection and feel that love and feel that wholeness, if you start to look at the planetary body and nature, you know, this includes nature, as your own,
right.
Then what you're doing is you're challenging yourself to bond on to self-bond, where it's not so dependent upon the human interaction that is, you know, constantly changing. It's constantly variable. And, you know, it's interesting because when we enter into relationship, one of the things that we want, one of the strongest drives is to get consistency from the other person. And yet we ourselves are not consistent. And yet we make this demand. So I mean, you know, once the nature of the planet becomes your beloved, then you'll understand that will always be there for you. And I think what you're doing is when you return to your interpersonal reality, and you've got all these different exchanges going on with people, it helps you to allow that variation and that inconsistency, because this is the nature of human love. It isn't consistent.
Perfectly stated. That has been my experience, and it's awesome because exactly I no longer need something, you know, what I always said, a square peg in a round hole to fit, because if it's not fitting, I'm not feeling not loved because it's not fitting. I'm still feeling loved. So now all I keep saying to everybody is, hey, let's go for a hike. I keep trying to get them out there.
You're becoming a source for your love hit. You're not having to approach other people saying, you know, with your umbilical cord in your hand going, can I plug
right.
in for a hit? You
right.
know, you've found a way to source so that now when you're getting together with people, you're not an addict looking for a fix. You're an observer looking for something interesting and new to learn, or you're you know, you're a companion looking for a good time just for fun, but you're not
yes.
having to worry about getting your hit because you've sourced it now. You've got something going that's yours exclusively, and it makes all the difference between whether or not you approach the relationship from a needy place or from an abundant place.
Yeah, because doesn't that seem with a lot of the tension, I mean, from the conversations I'm having with my friends, it's not that it's... The breaking point is when they're surrendering the need, but it seems that the whole fighting aspect is about, you know, why can't you be this? And, you know, like Robert said, because the nature is we don't stay stagnant, we change, you know. I mean, every moment things are changing, and we should adapt that into our paradigms of relationships, because we talked about this last time that, you know, people kind of get married with the hope that, okay, exactly how this is, freeze. Keep it like this for the next 20, 40 years and we'll be good. And that's just an unrealistic, that's not who we are as beings. That's not the universe we live in. We live in a universe that is, the one constant is change.
One guy
right.
pointed out the tendency for men and women. He says, women marry men thinking they're going to change and they don't. Men marry women thinking they won't change and they do.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
And that's really interesting to know.
Yeah, that is.
But we have to return to the environment of two people in relationship and all the things that can happen there. Now, what you've described, you know, about this relationship you have in nature, to me describes a beautiful ideal to bring into the environment of relationships and have that as being part of your locus of power.
Right.
But we also have to, we always have to look at what the ego is up to. We always have to look at what our fundamental nature does in the presence of love and in the presence of light. Now, human beings are afraid of the light. They crave it. They long for it. But they are fundamentally afraid of it. We resist it. And the ego does a very similar thing in the presence of love. Its response to love is to immediately deploy control. And control can and does take on many forms and disguises, all of which are designed to maintain the status quo of the ego, which is separation. and the vigilant protection of that state.
Distinctiveness.
So, say that again?
Distinctiveness, to preserve my sense of distinctiveness
exactly.
as a person.
Right. So
and
it's
not
drawn
be absorbed
to
into someone else, you know, or something.
That's it. It's drawn to this thing. It craves this thing that actually could mean its very annihilation. And so we really have to be present with, you know, our ego orientation and how it's pretty much always up to that one level or another.
Okay. Everybody okay, phone-wise? Okay, okay.
Yeah, there was some kind
a
of
a little static. Yeah, no, that's cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So and, is that what they mean by God is in the paradox, what you just stated, Robert?
Ooh, I don't know. Explain
well,
that.
Well, meaning we go after that which is going to set us free and at the same time be the demise of the ego, which is actually a death of a part of self. I mean...
Yeah.
Right, the identification, the identity, you know, the ego creates the identity,
right.
And its need to protect that separate identity is threatened in the presence of love, because love basically naturally creates a unity between people, and so that merging is a very potent threat to the ego. So you see what most people do when they get in relationships. Immediately it becomes this thing around possession, expectation,
yeah.
and control. And it can be very subtle. This is what I mean. It's like you really need to stage this investigation on the level of the game that you play. For instance, I play a very high-level game. I could be doing something, and I'm so crafty that I won't even know I'm doing it. And I'm somebody who pays attention to these things. So it depends on, you know, what your own relationship is with the ego. Sometimes it's really obvious, right? So in order to understand, to drive this point home, think about the fear you experience when you imagine your death, or if you can, not being ever able to reincarnate into another body. So what we're talking about here is total dissolution of the self, how intensely traumatizing this is to the ego and its sense of identity. Well, interestingly, the same fear is triggered when we enter into a deeply intimate bond. The loss of self and the fear of being overly penetrated by life and by this other person, in the form of this other person, is enormously threatening.
Hmm. Interesting that love threatens us, and it's all everybody talks about.
That's right.
And
I mean,
there's
of course,
your paradox.
Right.
That's who we're talking about, the paradox. I want it, and I run from it at the same time.
Exactly.
Well, Daniel, you had an experience recently, Daniel, that ties into this, didn't
I absolutely
you?
Did, in the fact that this last weekend, one of my closest and dearest friends transitioned, Shirley Simon, who was like a second sister to me, or actually a third sister. I have two half-sisters or one whole sister. from previous marriages of my folks, but Shirley was brought in by one of my sisters as a sort of a metaphysical replacement, because my blood sister was unable to really, in the marriage that she'd chosen, was unable to really practice her metaphysics and have the kind of fellowship around that we would have loved to have,
right.
Because her husband was just wouldn't allow it, and so she, for whatever reason, chose to stay. But she gave me Shirley in her place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Shirley became a traveling companion and was a very, very, very close friend, teacher, a mentor, because she traveled the world. She had been to all the healing places, all the special places. Of course, there's all the most popular places, Rome and Paris and Greece and all that. But
right.
She'd been to, like... healing waters and Medjugorje, I guess, is one of them, and all of these various places where people go to for special healings. She'd gone to the psychic surgeons in Manila and so on and so forth. She'd been around, and we called her a planetary acupuncturist because she would travel from place to place. So when she and I were very, very, very close, I think one of the best experiences we ever remembered in the last conversation we had, we brought it up, was one day we were walking on the beach in Laguna Beach, California, and it was a beautiful day. The sun was out, the skies were blue, the sands were just beautifully white. And I was standing there, we were standing by this big rock, and I had my arms around her, and she was looking out of the water, and this fellow appeared off in the corner of my vision, and he had a camera and a tripod, and he kept taking our picture. And then he'd move a little closer, and he'd take our picture, and he'd move a little closer. And finally I said, "Cheryl, I think we're being photographed." And so by the time he got to us, he introduced himself as someone who worked for the local commercial magazines, and he said that he wanted to know if we would be willing to give him permission to reproduce that picture, because he said he'd never seen such love between two people before.
Wow.
And so we both laughed about it and said, "Of course, yeah, that would be great." And so this last week, as she was preparing to make her transition, I felt so much of what she went through, because, you know, she was in hospice. She was, every day she was speaking about, is it going to be today? Is this going to be the time?
Wow.
And I went into meditation spaces. I would talk to her. I've been talking to her more than I ever did when she was on her normal living track. I went through, in many instances, some of this sense of trepidation and expectancy and desire, but at the same time fear about what might lie ahead, you know, to be or not to be, whether, you know, and that whole consideration of what it might be. Well, what if I've just been kidding myself all this time?
Right.
And maybe I'm just going to fade away and no one's ever going to see or hear from me again, you know. And so I went into all that, and believe me, it was a pretty edgy week.
Right.
And then when I got a call from her son on Sunday afternoon saying she died that morning and had gone, I thought to myself, wow, you know, I've sort of gone the gamut with this experience. And I didn't realize until Robert and I were talking this afternoon about, you know, these topics of love and the idea of death being a sort of a picture lesson for what happens when people come back together in their love relationship. They even, if you look at the French language, the word for orgasm in the French language is the words petit mort, which means the little death.
Oh, wow.
And so when people give themselves over in a blending, whether it's an experience or an act, or whether it's something more long-lasting, they do experience that kind of that thing where there's the we blends into a you and a me as one. And there's all kinds of fears that come up. There's all kinds of protective mechanisms and maneuvers. But eventually there's a lot of peace that comes up as you begin to understand that this thing that you've feared and you've desired and everything, it's really not that bad at all, and it's a lot easier than it was made out to be in your fearful times of doubt and trepidation. And so I could feel the peace immediately after I'd gotten that call, and I realized that she'd gone on. And we kept thinking, you know, at some point she's going to pop out of the woodwork somewhere and go, "Hi guys, I'm going to be with you now." We've had several friends who really loved her, and we've been talking about this, particularly my friend Nina and I, who've traveled down to visit her and be with her on many occasions, and who traveled with her in Europe. And Nina actually had an experience where she was jerked out of bed at night. She's an astral traveler. She was jerked out of bed into an environment very much like that you found in the movie The Matrix, where they created a construct where you could be with each other in some kind of a created environment, but you didn't know what it was. And there she was. She said, "I've never seen Shirley so vivid. I touched her. I felt her. I know it was real. It was beyond real.
Mm.
And yet there we were together. And so, you know, she had her experience of that. I had an incredible last conversation with Shirley where we recounted a lot of the things we'd gone through, what we meant to each other. When she was at her most lucid, her most peaceful, they had just brought her dinner. And I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "They just brought me my dinner." And I said, "Could we have dinner together?"
Mm.
And so we had this talk. And when at the end of the talk, I knew somehow I'd never talk to her again in the physical. And that was just fine because it was all contained in that conversation.
Mm.
But the love, you know, and the sense of deliberate consideration of all these fears of possibly being wiped out and never being heard from again, that was all contained in that week of preparation before she actually leapt into her transformation. And I felt it. I felt a good deal of it. And so when you're talking about that today, I said, "I think I know what you mean. I know what you're talking about."
Right.
Yeah, you were there, and you know the impending or actual death of a loved one brings us into that energy where we consider it ourselves. And what I'm contending here is believe it or not, that very powerful, enormously full body fear that we experience when we think about annihilation like that is actually present when we decide to go into relationship with someone. That
right.
is the level
wow.
of the threat to the ego, and you should never forget it. You should never forget it. So then when you start behaving in certain ways, even in ways that you don't recognize in yourself, depending upon the person that you've attracted, you can understand where it's coming from. And to answer your earlier question, Goldie, what we have to do, of course, is to learn to intervene. Because we have, you know, we have that side of us that is light and consciousness, and we will always have a dark side. We will always have a shadow side, and this is the relationship we have with ourselves. So it's important to start to learn that language and to understand that the ego is very motivated to go back to being separate, or if it's capable of deploying a certain level of control, it will feel safe enough to engage. So what Daniel beautifully articulated in the passing of his friend was the ultimate point of surrender.
Right.
And, you know, this is the only true power that we really have, is our ability to let go. And yet the ego and the mind, being acquisitive by nature, suggest that we can gain power through action or through a particular kind of process.
Right.
But I consider that to be a misnomer, because the real power is in our ability to let go. And when we do, you instantly go into a state of peace and joy.
Mm.
And there's so much strength in that. So it's to be able to watch this. Go ahead.
I believe it's indicative when you go into the peace, it's almost that you know you've surrendered. You know, that is
it's
the signpost of
true.
It. Yeah.
Either or. I mean, one can...
Right, right. But that can tell you that you're there, or... Yeah, no, indeed,
right.
Indeed.
Or tell you where you need to go, exactly. And it's, you know, I've had some personal experiences recently in intimate relationships where it was my only choice, really. I could see that it was not going... You know, trying to enforce my agenda, in other words, what I want or what I wanted, was not going to do anything. And
right.
so I let go. And I've been practicing this, you know, all of my adult life, so it's getting easier and easier.
Right.
And it was just, I mean, it was literally, it's literally blissful to do that. Or when you find yourself in judgment, to notice that and just relax the judgment, and immediately you will go into joy, into bliss.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes. But, you know, this the way the ego is organized so tenaciously around maintaining particular conditions is what creates the suffering.
A lot of people have asked me over the years, you know, it's been almost 20 years since I've been channeling the reconnections, what it's like to do that, because there's a lot of fear and a lot of desire on the part of people. There are a lot of people who would like to step forward and call themselves a channel and bring through truth and be of help to people.
Absolutely.
And they'll say, what's that like? And I'll say, you know, part of it has to do, when you step forward and say, I'm willing to wear the label of a channel, you know, you're coming face to face with all the fears and all the bugaboos that have been laid upon that over the centuries,
mm-hmm.
up to and including the idea of being possessed by the devil.
Right.
And when Joan of Arc was telling people about the voices she was hearing and how she ended up burned at the stake for that, and I stood in front of that Joan of Arc monument in Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, and I just couldn't hold it. I just broke down and cried. I had to sit down because it was so powerful, the feeling of being in the presence of that particular act. And so a lot of people have said, what's it like? You know, and I said, well, in a way, you have to walk into your greatest fear, which is the idea that if I open myself up, who knows, there might be the wolf man or the creature from the Black Lagoon or something, some terrorist would come through me.
Right.
And just like the guy who killed John Lennon said that he had to call upon the devil to get the power to do what he needed to do. And you're afraid, oh, my God, if I open myself up, I won't be able to stop myself. I'll completely lose control.
Right.
I remember when the... it was about 2 months into channeling. It was late at night, and I said to the guides, I said, I'm getting scared about this idea because I'm channeling this stuff now. I'm writing things down, and I'm afraid that somewhere along the line, I just might lose myself in the process. And, of course, I expected them to say, don't worry, we'll hang on to you. You know, we won't let you do that. We'll be here for you. But instead, there was just kind of a chuckle. And I remember Belshazzar, the host guide into the system, who simply said, well, if you do lose yourself, there could be an upside to it. You wouldn't be here to know that you're gone. And I said, thanks,
right.
Belt. I really appreciate it. That makes me feel so much better.
The comfort there is,
I feel very
at least they allow you to choose for yourself. God bless, right? I mean, that's the ultimate thing we have to remember is we are making these choices for ourselves.
We are.
Yeah.
And we're doing it because we want to, and we're doing it with full knowledge that we could, the woman we take out at the office could end up to be that gal in Fatal Attraction, you know, but asking
right.
her out is
right.
the first step, you know. And
Right.
I hate the fact that the guy's name was Dan in the movie, you know.
Yeah, no, trust me, there's no qualities that, at least from my perspective, that bring me anywhere to Michael Douglas when I think of you, that movie, when I think of
Glenn,
you. You're,
Glenn,
you're
Glenn,
a beautiful soul.
Thank you. Glenn Close leaned forward and she goes, Dan, you're not going to forget me. You don't think I'm going to let you forget me. And I'm going, I won't forget you. I won't forget you. Scared the patooties out of everybody that year. There's a lot of men who stayed faithful after that.
That's truth. That's just like Jaws kept us out of the beach.
Yeah.
That movie kept, what do they call it, in discrepancies, whatever, it, out of the offices. That is absolute truth.
And then Julia Roberts had one, too, where she had a guy who ended up being possessive, and he kept her well, but he kept her locked in a little glass
sleeping
house.
Sleeping with the enemy, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Sleeping with the enemy. I mean, oh,
yeah.
My God, you know, there are women out there who think, well, it would be nice to find this dark, mysterious man, but you never know, you know, a dark, mysterious man who just happens to put you in a house and keep you a prisoner, you know.
If you don't take the
risk, you'll never know, and right. you will have already made that... fear come true by kowtowing to it. So,
right.
I need to jump in here, Daniel. I need to jump in here because
jump, go.
We don't want to breed the notion of random events occurring or random attraction. It doesn't exist. Whatever we end up encountering in another person is first of all tailor made for us to basically expand our consciousness. Grow and learn, and I know, of course, that you know this, but we really.
I know it mentally, but not emotionally, and particularly when I'm in it. Certainly doesn't feel tailor-made, but I know what you're saying, and I'm going, that's where the split occurs, you know, on one
that's
side.
That's where the split occurs.
We know it mental, but physically and emotionally, we still believe the dream, don't we?
Mm-hmm. We do, and that's
and the
it.
Movies.
We're believing the dream. This is why these movies were made, right, because it reflects that part of our consciousness. But, you know, our job is to figure out the perfection of the connection, even if it's challenging, even if it's violent, even if it's difficult. It's not this question about how it happened and, oh, I made a bad choice. You can't make a bad choice. You cannot.
Right.
You attract what you are. And there is a sequence of unfolding that occurs that is connected to your soul's agenda. And we march through these things as lessons. And to take that kind of responsibility, what it requires a great deal of what I like to term spiritual trust,
right,
in that,
yeah,
you don't question the conditions. You figure out why you're there. That is the responsibility behind it. It takes an enormous amount of
time. Well, and it can set you free when you understand why you're there. Then the choice becomes a choice instead of just maybe an unconscious pull.
I like
that
word,
was
the perfection of a connection. He made that rhyme. That was good. I like that.
the perfection of the connection. Getting back to this willingness that you were talking about, Daniel, to become a channel, you know, the difference there, the thing to me that makes the critical difference is, well, two things, grounding and intention. And, you know, in order to do that, in order to open yourself up to multidimensional information like that, you have to be enormously grounded or you could potentially be taken over. It's a fact. And which is why, you know, historically, there was a lot of question around the whole thing. And the clear channels, unfortunately, suffered from the general consensus that they were crazy or that they were dabbling in energies and in places that they shouldn't have been.
Well, I think their bodies also took like a beating, so to speak, when they, you know, they, like Helen Blavatsky was very ill, and Bailey was, you know, taken ill. Do you feel ill after you channel, or do you feel drained?
There have been times, yes. I have, particularly in the early days, I would have a feeling after I wrote a really potent transmission,
right,
I would have a feeling like I had ingested some kind of bad sausage, you know.
Really?
And you know, like my body, in other words, my body was bringing in some foreign energy and was mixing and mingling it with the rest of me. Now, after a while, it became very apparent that it wasn't bad, it was just new. And
okay,
so there were, it created a necessity for us to rewire my energy system so that it could accommodate that new energy. But it was back in those times also when I used to, you know, I do body work, and it went hand in hand with that, because when you get into another human being's energy field, particularly when you're in a healing mode, oftentimes you're taking that energy on that seems to,
yep,
be troubling them, and you're bringing it into your system and,
yep,
using your system to balance and refocus it, and then you're either giving it back to them or you're sending it on its way, wherever it needs to go. It all depends on what the agenda is for that particular energy. But, you know, I remember once working on a woman who was very poetic, very talented, but she had some very, very dark sides to her. And during the session, after a couple of the sessions, it took me about 2 days to integrate the energies that had passed from her to me.
Wow.
And there are a lot of people who say, well, you know, you put up a white light around you, or you have a bubble, or you wear white light and gloves and do various things. But when it comes right down to it, there are some energies that are so potent that you can't keep them away. You know, they're going,
right,
to come into your system. And you must be able to have within you something sufficient to neutralize it. By that, I mean exactly what Robert just brought up in the conversation. You know, I'm verbalizing the fear, and he's verbalizing the truth about that, which is there's no surprises, there's no mistakes, there's nothing,
right,
that can come into you that isn't also a part of your who you are in the greater sense. It may have been something you've forgotten for a time, but when it comes to you, it comes home, even though it feels like, oh my gosh, who's just tracked that stuff in on the, into my carpet? You know, and then
right.
you realize,
yeah.
oh, this is my son back from the war, you know,
yeah.
and
yeah.
So
right.
welcome him in and give him some soup and let him sit by the fire and get used to being part of the family again.
Right.
And so that was something I had to deal with and still do to a degree, but much less traumatic now than before.
I'm glad for that.
Hence the need for scrupulous energetic hygiene, the ability to clear yourself, protect yourself, or get cleared, you know, after these events. Ultimately, the only energies that can stick are ones that we have a relationship with, and when they do stick and create problems for us, it becomes a lesson. The only problem here is that, as you mentioned, Daniel, some of these energies are lethal. Some of these can take you out, and so you've got to be careful, you know, around that as well. So again,
but when
you know,
when you say lethal, what do you mean? Literally kill you? Like
yes.
your body?
Yeah, some could, sure.
Yes. Yeah, well, you named it perfectly, Goldie. You mentioned Blavatsky and also Jane
yeah.
Roberts.
Okay, Seth. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so this can happen. This can happen. Now, you know, there's different types of channeling, of course, and Daniel knows this you know, better than I do, where, you know, basically an energy or an entity comes in and basically takes your body over. And uses it.
Right.
That you probably run the highest risk of some physical problems as a result of that. Yeah,
okay.
I channel as well, but I do what I term interpretive channeling, and so the I'm in my body fully. My consciousness is influenced by these energies that are basically trying to communicate through me, but I never give my body over to another force in that way. I had to learn over a period of many, many years not to do that because, I mean, you could see it in my astrology, but I'm wired to do that, actually. And this ability to merge with these multidimensional energies is part of my matrix. So I had to learn, you know, the hard way, really, to how to go into these situations and maintain the proper boundaries, really. And yet, be open to the information that was coming through.
Yeah,
it's interesting that in my particular experience, I carry some of those energies with me as part of my security system. What you would consider to be the darker tones, they don't necessarily color my life and intention. But if there's ever anybody who comes into my space who has covert agenda with wanting to use the message and the power of whatever we do as reconnections, you can see them interacting with those darker tones because the darker tones begin to work with them almost like customs agents that meet them at the gate and shake them down and say, you know, what's your ID? What are you doing here? That particularly that's happened on several occasions with females who wanted to get close to me, not because they were particularly dedicated to what I was doing, but just because I was a public figure and they were curious about what that was about. And so you could see that in some instances they got out of there quick because there was a sense in which they could sense there was something in there. It wasn't anything I was particularly consciously projecting, but it was part of the contract. You know, you've got to be able to handle darker tones if you're going to be in this space. If you're all just care bears and lovey-dovey stuff, you better not hang out here because there's more that goes on here. As
so
Shakespeare
true.
Said, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Yeah,
well, I
so
think
true.
It's important that we're talking about this because I believe that what's happening energetically is, you know, it's not just blending the male and the female. It's also blending the light and the dark. I mean,
yes, it is. Absolutely.
So, and I agree with what you said that it's, I think the dark that comes to us is really something that we've shunned maybe in this lifetime, in another lifetime. You know, it is still, you know, the signature us, and so it's about embracing now. Now, and I'm not saying this is easy, because it's petrifying to embrace. Like, for me, what I had to embrace was being alone. That was so scary for me to do. I didn't know nature was even an option, per se, at the time. So, you know, I used to just wait for, you know, the bars to just be about closing and, you know, find the drunkest guy, because then I don't have to be alone. You know, and
Mm-hmm.
clearly that doesn't, you know, that's what I call the toxic time of Goldie's life.
The experimental time.
The experimental, like, when do I get out of this planet time? Where now, it's, you know, I understand that when I'm really, and this is, like, genuine, when I'm really, like, God, I just need to feel some love, my mind doesn't even go to a person. It's immediately rain, shine, snow, cold, hot, mosquitoes. Just go to the woods, Goldie. You know what you need, so just go be there. And you know, it's like I think it's about embracing the fact that I, you know, first it was being alone that was the darkness for me, but that alone, when I did embrace it, has grounded me. What you two are talking similarly, where I believe I can definitely handle the stronger winds, so to speak, because I am grounded in that piece of darkness. I have other dark pieces that are coming in. But that one happens to be, you know, what I think was a life lesson. And Robert, you might be able to talk about this. I don't know if people have life lessons, but being alone is something that has plagued me, because I was molested when I was young, so that made me be afraid to be alone. And it literally 3 days into my 45th year, it came to me at least as an awareness. It was already here as an experience, but the awareness came to me that I have overcome being alone, because I enjoy my own company and find it, you know, whatever I need in the woods. So it's like,
yeah.
Oh, okay, completion. That has been completed. And, you know, so.
Well, the thing about alone is, you know, alone is the compacted interpretation of it. If you expand the term alone, it becomes all one.
Yeah, indeed.
And so when you move from the expanded aspect of alone, you realize that we're all one. None of us is alone. We're all part of the same one self. And in a very real sense, on the flip side of that, we're all alone, because we come in alone, we go out alone, and yet we're all one. You know, so it's all these pair. You know, you kept using the term the paradoxes, and there they are again. You know.
Right. Right.
Well, so realizing you're alone, but we're also all one, you know, so that's the flip side of it. There's lots.
Well, and isn't that about every darkness? I mean, doesn't every darkness, if you move up in, move out in consciousness, will turn into the opposite aspect? In other words, alone, the opposite is all one.
Right.
So wouldn't all darkness aspects turn into the opposite of it? You know, the lying and the truth. And
at their extreme, that's the phenomena that occurs.
What my belief about it is.
I carry
that as a belief. Yeah.
But you know, to answer your question, Goldie, this thing about being alone and being petrified of that has to do with it. That's a root chakra issue, and
okay.
If a person experiences sexual abuse early in life, it can disturb that connection, because the root chakra is basically part of the way we connect and develop a root chakra is through our family. And so if there's a disturbance there, if there's aberrations there, you may not have your own personal root chakra, and so you're constantly needing to connect to someone else's in order to
feel safe.
Wow. And, you know, it's interesting how many people actually do this. They don't know that there's that intention. But what we, you know, these people who seem to be compulsively unable to be with themselves, sometimes even for a day or a night, is there's a real need to reestablish the root chakra there. And their thinking is, well, you know, that person over there has one, I'll just plug into them. And the interesting thing is that you can absolutely get some juice from that. But obviously there's a real heavy dependency and need behind it.
There's
and
a price that's paid for it, that's for sure.
There's a
huge,
price that's paid, exactly.
I believe that's also what's behind the technical definition of what's called a borderline personality. Although a lot of what are called borderline personalities, I think more shamanic. Because the shamans are the ones that live on the borderlines.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a sense, you might say one of the reasons you don't have a root chakra of your own is so that you can plug in easily to these
right.
various other dimensions. You can plug in and also pull the plug back out. And so if you're not attached or overly identified with any particular one dimension, then you can visit any others. So I you know, the psychological, what they would call the disorder aspect of that is that failure to attach. On the other side, the advantage of is that's your shamanic ability to be able to connect anywhere at any time with anyone, sort of like a Kwai Chang Kane thing, you know, always wandering on the edge.
Right, but the most effective way to be able to connect in this shamanic way that you're describing is to also be grounded. Otherwise,
right.
you get absorbed by that thing that you connect with. So
yes.
it's much more powerful. Now, I believe that the true shamans, the authentic shamans in the world, did exactly that. They had a deep connection with the planet. And you
mm-hmm.
could see it in their plant medicine, for instance.
Yeah.
They knew how to connect deeply with the planet and also go multidimensional, and that's what made them so powerful. And it's also interesting to examine how unique their lives were. I mean, it's very popular these days to go to shaman school and become a shaman,
yeah.
And it's like, you know, think that you could basically. First of all, shamans were chosen. They didn't choose to be shamans. They were chosen. They were chosen by their tribe. They were chosen by their environment. And now it's it's this other way around where people want to experience that kind of empowerment.
Hanging out
and
of shingles does not make you a shaman. You know.
And going and stepping through a series of lessons and experiences that are created for you by your shaman guide or teacher doesn't do it either. You know, these people had experiences that literally blew their psyches apart.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And they had enough, they came in with enough core strength to remember those pieces. And that's what made them shamans, because of that dynamic range was greater than anyone else's. It usually was on the heels of great trauma and difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, these people, in many ways, I feel like I'm one of them. You know, I've had to put myself together over many decades and remember myself, reassemble myself as a response to, as a healing response to the intense dissociation that occurred in my early life. And, you know, it's been a shamanic journey in that way, but it's not an easy one. It's not something that you use to impress people. Because
that's where you get the expression, please don't squeeze the shaman, you know.
Don't squeeze the shaman. I constantly tell people that.
That's where
you become
a real role model, you know what I'm saying.
For shamans and toilet paper.
It better yet, please squeeze the shaman.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. Exactly.
The shaman
is looking for a squeeze. I do think people are, it's the earth connection. They might be labeling it shamanism, but what's awakening is that, you know, they sit in front of their computers and or TVs, you know, and or whatever other type of electronic, and there's a calling within them that's going, hey, maybe we should go roll in the dirt for a little while and, you know, go smell an actual rose instead of sending just a internet one to your loved one. You know, it's like about kind of living life instead of just watching it through the internet or the TV. That's what I think that whole rush of shamanism is. Yeah, as well as, you know, mysticism and stuff.
And in a way, when you say, I go off in the woods, isn't that your version of making the earth your lover? I mean,
of course. That's exactly,
spirit.
Yes. Yeah, that's where
that's
my perspective
shaman.
Comes from.
Very
yeah.
Shaman.
Yeah.
So.
There's this thing, I want to get back to what Goldie was talking about, because I feel like it's infinitely important, and I feel that it infiltrates the fabric of almost every relationship, if not all. And this is whole thing around loneliness.
Mm.
At some point along the way, you kind of wake up and realize that it's kind of a form of spiritual arrogance to think that you can actually be alone. Because look around you. And you know, how can you be alone with all this going on?
Yeah.
But when we become very specific about how we want to solve that aloneness, in other words, with another person, then it becomes a different matter. But you know, we all have to encounter this sooner or later, one way or the other, because we, you know, as it goes, we come in alone, we leave alone, and so it is paradoxical. We are alone, and yet we're not. And then you see how some people truly, truly ache when they don't have that omnipresent reflection in the form of a partner. And you can see the poverty there. You really can.
Oh,
and,
great
and
word. Yes.
It's not a judgment. It's a condition. It's a condition of impoverishment that needs to be healed. And so, you know, many of us, if not most of the people I know in my life, have had at least a temporary destiny with this level of loneliness that you were describing, Goldie. And you know, when you touch the depths of your loneliness, you really have your hands on the very door to your soul when you allow yourself to go there. And that's such a critical place. And if you don't pull back and keep going, and oftentimes your life circumstances will provide that for you.
Exactly.
That's when you really break through and you really understand that you cannot be alone.
Yeah, no, and ironically, I can't be alone, and yet on the same note, I have an appointment with the woods. Like, if I'm with people, you know, let's just say 5 days in a row for 12 to 14 hours, I mean, on the sixth day, I by my own sanity, go, I got to go to the woods, and I got to do it by myself. You know, it actually became something now that I crave, the alone time, the physical body being alone in the woods. Because when I'm there by myself, and it's not that I don't get the healing when I take, you know, groups in, but there's the silence of it, and there's this conversation that's so personal between me and the experience, and it's not that I don't want to share it. It can't be. I don't know how to share it. Because it's happening within me. It's not happening on the outside of me. So that's kind of ironic, the paradox as well. Now I actually say, oh, Goldie needs alone time, and you know, I chuckle because all my life it was like, don't leave me! Don't leave me!
Precisely. So this is a great, I mean, what you've done and what you've found on your own is, you're installing this very critical piece that I would actually recommend everybody do in one way or another. They don't have to do it the way you're doing it, but I would recommend it because if you, you know, when you're capable of being alone, I mean, really, and, you know, not having it be an issue, you can move in and out of being alone pretty much at will, and doesn't create a negative condition for you. You bring so much more to the environment of your relationships when you do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I mean, if you know, when you think about it, if you want to be with someone so that you don't have to feel the pain of being alone, all you're doing is exploiting that individual. You're not having a real relationship with them.
Hmm.
What I would love to see when people find each other and they begin down a track of togetherness, whether it would be destined to be a short one or one that endured for years and years, it would be just great if they could have their breakup right at the beginning. Because everybody, you know, a lot of times people will stay in relationships long after they're really technically done because of the fear of the breakup. So if we were to get the breakup over, you know, from the very beginning, a couple of things would happen. First of all, we'd learn that you can survive any breakup. You can survive anything from that viewpoint. But the second thing being is that you never really know the quality of the relationship itself until you look at each other's demeanor of how you handle that person as they're walking out the door. If you can look at them and say, it's been a wonderful time being with you, I wish you all the best, and thank you for this time we've had, that is a relationship that could have gone on and probably would go on for a long, long time. If, however, the whole thing has been about suspending the idea of having to deal with the fear of breaking up and having to go through the lost thing, then you never really knew that person. The only thing you were doing was clinging to them, trying to avoid the pain of this abandonment thing. And so if we got the abandonment thing just out of the way right away, that would be wonderful. I wish it was something that could be worked into the ritual, but some people manage to do it. And actually, I've observed in my own self over the years since I went through, I only had one marriage and one divorce. I sort of always think in terms of that, you know, if you ever divorce once, it's kind of silly to marry again.
Right.
But that's just my thinking, because you always know, and anybody who's with you always knows that at some point you'll pull the pin, because you've done it already.
Right.
But
right.
Some people need to have that in order to stay in line with some kind of traditionalism with themselves. But the idea being is that if you could just go through that I will simulate that. Sometimes there'll be like a fight that is deliberately set so that you can draw first blood, so you can get to each other and see how you are in the clinches. What was it that Neo said to that guy in the second Matrix movie? They said, you never really know someone until you fight them. It was an interesting,
right.
He and the guy, the guy who was...
I never heard that before. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's when he fought that Oriental man who was supposed to be the bodyguard for the what did they call her, the Oracle.
Yeah.
And he said, you never really know someone until you fight them. And so sometimes if I find myself attracted to someone, I will watch myself. I'll notice how I'll bring up some sort of a little thing that would necessitate someone standing up for themselves, and it would result in what we would think of as a squabble or even a fight. So as to say, okay, what's the answer here? Is the answer that you just start demeaning someone, or is it possible for you to agree to disagree at any given point in time, and does that make the other person evil, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You start projecting
your
dark
all
over each other. Or is it just that, okay, we stumbled on each other, so what? So what are we going to do about it, that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, because I'm at this point looking for the relationship that at least is at a point where there is no blame, because, I tell people when I'm going into the relationship with them, it's like, I'm going to let you know right now, I won't blame you for anything. I'm not saying I won't be triggered by you. And I'll take my personal stuff and I'll, I might be scarce for a while. But on the same note, I'm not going to listen to you say, it's all your fault that I feel this way. It's like,
right.
I want you to be as self-reflecting as I am. Otherwise, I'm taking on my responsibility and I'm taking on your responsibility. And personally, that's just too much responsibility for me to take on. I'm not going to do that.
But there are some people who will not play in the game unless they get to play both sides of the net. I'll often hear someone say, I don't want you to feel this, or I don't want you to feel that. And it's like, gee, how are you so omnipotent that you can stand there like Moses and prevent me from feeling something? I mean, that's pretty powerful.
Well, you can feel, but the blame is what usually, I have trouble with the blame, because I won't blame them in the sense that I'll own the feeling within me. I'm created this, but I'm not going to look at you and go, you have made me feel bad. No, I feel bad because you've triggered me. Now let me go find out what that means.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But most people who are not in the conscious world, it's all about, it's guilt and shame. And I have very little patience now, for especially with this, you know, newborn ability sovereignty. With the, I mean, I was dating for like a little bit a couple of months ago, and I had a couple of relationships. I mean, the guy was blaming me, not blaming me, but he goes, listen, you haven't slept with me. I'm sexually frustrated, and it's affecting my work. I went,
now there's a good line.
I went, well, who's got the problem here? I went, well, so take care of yourself. And he was like, no. You know, he was like, I can't do that. And I was like, well, listen, and it was interesting because it initially triggered me, and I went, okay, I'll take care of you. And then, you know, after I hung up the phone, I sat with that and realized that was an old paradigm playing out, and pretty much called him back and said, wait a minute, I need to refresh that thought because I'm not taking care of you. I mean, I'll do it because I choose to do it, not because you're threatening me because your job is being affected. And then we just stopped seeing each other because I went, those are the terms. The terms are, I'm not going to do it. Take care of yourself until I'm ready to do it. And he didn't like that, so he just stopped calling.
And Goldie, that was a subtle, if I may, that was a
please,
subtle
please.
Resonation. That was a subtle resonation, a very subtle ripple of the resonation that was created from the sexual abuse, because the subscript
yes.
was the same.
Oh, and yes, that, very good, very good.
Yes.
The subscript
yes.
was the same. In other words, you were supposed to be there for him sexually because of his, you know, his desire or his need or whatever. So what you've got there is an indication that you're healing, number one.
Exactly,
because,
yes,
because,
thank you.
But you could also see how powerful that stone that was dropped into the center of the pond, you can see how powerful that was because it's still playing out 45 years later.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
However many years.
Well, right, this is, it's relatively new that I'm recognizing I have a voice to say no.
Yeah.
That is a very new experience for me. And it's not so brand new because this time when I didn't say it, like I said, once I hung up the phone, it was like my soul came rushing into me going, for real? What did you just forget that you're okay now? You know, it was like, oh, yeah, I guess I am okay. I don't have to do something to – because I read the script was, this is what you now have to start doing to make sure this relationship works. Where the new script came in and said, my significant other is the woods. I don't have to do this anymore.
I would submit to you that whole experience of him making that case and you going back and forth in your mind and coming to that conclusion and making that statement, that was a significant sexual encounter. And you had yourself the climax of the century. Because you went back and you basically reversed a flow of energy that was begun on you when you were five or whenever it all happened back then.
Right.
And like Robert brought up so astutely, you know, you reversed that flow that said, no, it's not my responsibility. You know, go get a hold of yourself, bud. Take things in hand.
Yeah. Literally, yeah.
That's the intervention I was referring to earlier. That's the critical intervention that has to happen. And you can take it. You could take it even a step further. You don't even have to make him wrong. If you just encounter him basically as, again, a reflection of a part of your consciousness that is healing. You can turn to him and thank him for bringing you that lesson because that's ultimately what he's doing anyway. He's just the messenger. And
right.
and so you go, okay, well, this is where I am with that. Wow, I've come a long way. And
yes.
not only that, I can go even further because as you continue to clear this, you'll attract a completely different person. One, for instance, that would be as concerned about what your needs and expectations were around a sexual encounter as well, and they would honor that. And so this is where you're actually going. And this is the fast track to getting out of this hole where we think we are being victimized by our life experiences and by other people. If you really bow to them and have this reverence that they're bringing you information about yourself, really,
right.
And it's much more neutral than it appears. They wander onto your stage for a while, and they play this role. But the interesting thing is you scripted that role. You're the director. Always.
Now, here's another one to throw out into the pot just for fun. I'd love to get you guys' comment on this. Of equal importance is once let's say a man and a woman have had sex, and after the first time, the next day, he all of a sudden gets the desire, or doesn't have a desire to immediately call her back up and initiate some sort of an ongoing thing around that. Maybe he's still having to deal with the intensity of the experience. Maybe he's got stuff within him to sort that out. And, of course, everything I make about him and her could easily be reversed, too, because there are women who don't want to talk the day after, although it's
right.
less common. Then one of the biggest complaints a woman would have, in other words, is that he would have sex with her one night and then she wouldn't hear from him for a week. And what does she do with that, and what does that mean? What do you guys think about that in terms of, you know, what that brings up for you if all of a sudden he or she doesn't particularly want to, you know, start down the normal track of, quote, relationship now that we've signed it, now that we've done the do, we've done the deed, and now what does that mean about us, you know?
Can I share first, Robert? I want to hear you because I know you're going to give, like, a brilliant answer. And the only reason why I want to share first is because it was the second relationship I had within the month. That happened to me. And the truth be told, the way I experienced it was when I did have sex with this new guy, I found that everything in me was still in the space of what we were talking earlier. He would he texted, we did the deed on Saturday night. He texted me a couple of lines on Tuesday. Thursday, I got another text, or I sent him a text and said, are we getting together this weekend? He's like, I don't know. And by that point, I went, okay, we're done. I was like, because I said, I personally realized for myself, because I think part of it was I jumped into the second one and did have sex, even though the first guy I didn't, which is something I had to look at with myself. And the minute I had sex, I was definitely feeling, okay, listen, I need there to be an intimacy continuation, because for me, that's what exchanging us within our bodies is creating. I want the intimacy, and what I learned from the relationship is, okay, so don't do that on the first or second date, because establish the intimacy first, then when the sex comes, it'll seem more, I won't have to text the guy to say, because I even texted him, I would have called you, but a text seems so much more appropriate, because that's all he was doing with me, was texting me. He wasn't even calling me, which, again, was another level of lack of intimacy for me. And finally, I went, you know, I mean, it was a nice, enjoyable experience, but it ain't all that in a bag of chips. I'll just go to the woods.
Well, I have a different I have a different perspective on this, and
I had
wait,
a feeling.
Can't wait. We're waiting.
I'm gonna challenge you a little bit. Not that you even have to answer this, but you know, the thing is, we go when we have a sexual experience with someone, we go into unity with them, and it's hard sometimes to pull out of it because it feels so good.
Okay.
The conditions we place around the withdrawal are basically from the ego, and we need to look at that. In other words, what's going to make me feel comfortable? Now, listen, I'm on the same page with you here. From my very human self, part of myself, I would want the follow-up too. You know, I would want to be
right.
able to make that connection with that person and sort of continue the intimacy, because the truth of it is you're still having sex with that person for 3 to 21 days after you've had sex with them energetically.
Okay.
That's an energetic phenomena. So there is you're right in the sense that it's continuing, right? Now,
okay.
Based on how much wholeness you bring to that experience, you can have sex with someone and never hear from them again and be completely okay with it. If you can
right.
emerge from that as whole, as the unity you found through the sexual experience with them. Now, I'm speaking, obviously this is an ideal, right? And again, we have to be very careful. What part of us is communicating this? Again, my lower self wants to reconnect with that person, talk to them on the phone, see them again, all that stuff. I totally get that. So we're not judging
that. You would think of that as part of your lower self.
When I say lower self, I don't mean
lower chakras. You're talking about the lower chakras.
Yeah,
that's what I thought.
Yeah, I don't mean lower bat. I mean lower chakras, exactly.
Right, right. But I would say, you know, you're saying, in other words, that's a representation of the first three chakras, not necessarily the upper three.
Exactly, exactly.
Right.
And so, again, you know, just consider, Goldie, that you and everyone, all of us, are in school here. And really look at that thing. It's like, what part of me really needs the follow-up from this guy? And when I basically ended it with him, was I retaliating? Was I punishing him? You know, was I punishing him for not giving me the follow-up that I wanted, even though we didn't sign a contract around what that follow-up looked like?
Absolutely. 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 And,
so
and that's what I'm also, like, I'm kind of clear on my own experience that, you know, like Daniel, when you were saying that, you know, there's parts of you that might feel young, you know, emotionally young, I literally feel emotionally young when it comes to being in a sexual relationship. I really do. Even though I've probably had, you know, more sex than the average person in their lifetime, it's the dance of the intimacy and the actual relationship of it.
Yeah.
I have not done barely at all. I really haven't. Not from an authentic place.
Well, and
so
there's not a lot of people who would admit that, Goldie, but I hear exactly what you're saying, and I think if truth be told, there are a good deal of us who would probably be most truthful to say that when it gets to sexuality, it particularly the definitions of sexuality we've placed on it in this particular society, most of us are still in adolescence. We've been frozen in adolescence, and we haven't been able to go past the idea of something more enduring, something more
universal. More sacred? Is it more sacred? That's what I'm thinking. I'm looking for.
Well,
no,
the reason. I'm sorry, Robert. You had something else you wanted to say.
No, go ahead, Daniel. You were going to say something. Go ahead.
The reason I asked you the question when I did is because, in a way, there was a flip side to what would be the word, the demand factor. The demand factor was, on his part, was this isn't a relationship and you're failing me if you don't have sex in the first place.
Right.
And the unspoken demand part on your side was, if you don't do certain things after we've had sex, then this isn't a relationship and you've failed me.
Brilliant.
And the fact is that on both sides, it's the same kind of demand factor.
The same agenda. You're brilliant, Daniel.
That's never been negotiated, never been discussed. It's just, you might even say in our society, it's taken for granted. And yet, in a mature sexual romantic relationship, nothing should be taken for granted. Everything should be discussed and negotiated, because we need to understand that everybody's an individual and everybody does things, sees things, and needs things differently.
Right.
So this is okay. Now you're doing, you know, what you're presenting here, Daniel, is brilliant, because this is really when we transition from what we've been doing, the known, the tried and not so true, into this new paradigm of relating, which is so essential. What we've done here is laid the groundwork to understand how the old paradigm doesn't work. It collapses on itself.
Right.
And this has been a brilliant example of how subtle these expectations that really erode unity and love can be, and how quickly they assert themselves. They're right there. Poised to take action on behalf of the ego, really. So we need to move into, at this point, I think, describing how this is going to be different in the future.
Okay.
Because we are, you know, we are being prompted to evolve our relationship nature. And what we're really doing, of course, is evolving our relationship with ourselves. Yeah. And so what does this look like? You know, this is the brave new world here.
Looks like Goldie masturbating in the woods.
Okay, that's one answer. You know,
I'm just throwing it out there because we needed a giggle right there. So.
You know what? Can I?
Of course, you can do anything you want, Robert.
I'm trying to get a visual on this.
There you go. It's all good.
I want to expound on the wisdom of what you just said, maybe unknowingly, because really you just hit it. I mean, honestly, you hit it on the head in terms of what I understand the next step to be, which is self-bonding. And let me explain this before you go too far. So people might say, well, okay, what is self-bonding? Does that mean I have to masturbate in the woods? It's like, no. It's a willingness. It really comes down to a willingness to be there for yourself on every level, so that you can cultivate a new type of wholeness that you've never had before. And this is what we're being prompted to do right now, is to be there for ourselves on every level so that we don't lay that trip on someone else, directly or indirectly, you know, openly or covertly, and to really be responsible for it in that way. Now imagine, a world of people who have taken on this responsibility to self-bond on every level, and then they go out and they engage interpersonally. How different that would look. We would change the world overnight.
We would
that
change
way.
The world overnight. I agree.
Yes.
I agree.
For one thing, you know, there's a wonderful song in the movie My Fair Lady that says, why can't a woman be more like a man?
Love that song.
And that song is so incredible because when you have a situation, let's talk about this fellow who texted you on Tuesday.
Okay.
What I look at that situation, what I see is I see a fellow who might have been abused seriously, either by a mother or by other lovers, in the fact that it was always laid down, you know, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, if you kiss me, then you owe me this. If you hug me, then you owe me that. If I have sex with you, then you owe me this. And it was all written down, but never negotiated. It was all just expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly, here's a guy who has sex with a woman, and he immediately expects that the other shoe's going to fall. You know, if he doesn't call her the next day or send her flowers or do the usual romantic thing, then he's considered to be a louse. Now, does he want to be a louse? No. Just like I don't think you wanted to be celibate with that one that you didn't want to have sex with because you weren't ready.
Right.
What you were doing is you were testing the waters to see, is it possible that we could just have sex and not have anything attached to it, no strings, no expectations, just do what we do and make it okay in that little block of time, like put a frame around that picture and not have it connected with anything in the past or in the future, but just have it be a moment in time where we came together. And people say, what does this mean? Well, it means that in a moment of time, we made a choice, period.
Right.
You know, that's called digital living as opposed to analog living, which says that if you do this, then it automatically, you know, means this.
Creates other things.
In other words, it grows like a plant throughout your entire house. And before you know it, it's like the day of the Triffids. You're taken over by all these plants that eat you alive. These expectations eat you alive. The fact of the matter is that you both felt like it, and it was good, but it doesn't mean anything more than we want to make it mean when we decide to do it. Now, this is perfectly illustrated, and I always use movies as illustrations, but the movie Stayin' Alive, which is the sequel to Saturday Night Fever,
okay,
had a great relationship sequence in there where this guy, Tony Manero, who's supposed to be this hotshot center of the neighborhood, the hot dancer, John Travolta, who's always got women after him, always got women who want him to call back and this, that, and the other. And suddenly he meets this lady dancer, and they get together, have a hot afternoon, and it's the best sex he's had in a long time, and she doesn't call him back. She doesn't even acknowledge that anything happened. It was just like it happened, and then there was nothing there. And
right.
Suddenly, because she didn't fall into the normal pattern, it left a void there. It left a space in which the only one who could fall into that pattern, if it was going to be complete, was him. In other words, since there was no one there to wear the idea of, well, we had sex, now we have to do this and this and this, he automatically picked it up and he didn't even realize it. So all of a sudden, he's the one who's getting heavy. You know from his history and relationship that he's never that way. He's usually the free-for-all, let's have sex and forget about it kind of guy. Suddenly he's getting heavy. Why? Because she didn't do the normal things that he expected to have her do.
Right.
And so
she also showed him what he was doing with other people.
She reflected him back, exactly.
She reflected
right.
him back, and then he had nothing to do but to play out the other side of that. And for the
That's
first
it.
Time, he got to see it on a personal level. I call that an energy transposition, which means that he becomes himself, or he becomes the other person suddenly when someone becomes him. You know, you get to see
He experienced that exactly.
Experientially.
Exactly.
What a gift these people are when they come along and show us what our egos do and what they're up to.
They're worth their weight in gold, you know. And,
yes,
and
they
that's
are.
Why That's why
we're the first ones that want to throw them out, though, when they happen.
No.
You know? We want to throw them out because how dare you do that? How dare you show me me? You know?
No, you want to hold on to these people. You want to hold on to these people. In the Carlos Castaneda books, Don Juan told Carlos, you know, when you find your petty tyrant, you know, this person who just gets under your skin, and upsets you and throws you off balance, you don't want to lose them. You don't. And he said you don't want to kill them because the level
right.
of what was going on in this story or in these stories was it was that extreme. He goes, the last thing you want to do is lose them because they are helping you dismantle your ego, and that's what you have to do in order to be free.
Exactly.
So,
that's the shaman work, yes. Yes.
Well, at
so
least the control part of the ego. I would say that not the entire ego, but I would just say the control part of the ego. There's
exactly.
Also,
there's
also the
ego.
Childish part of the ego that appreciates the experience and gets to see things from an awe and wonder point of view. I never want to lose that. But the part of me that expects and is programmed and automatically goes into certain patterns when other patterns go down, I mean, that's the kind of stuff we want to get to and dismantle, because that's the thing blocking our adventure. Just like Jung used to say, religion is the greatest defense against a religious experience. By saying, this is what I believe, you're automatically closing the door to everything else you could be believing. Because
Never.
You say, this is what the truth is, then you're automatically closing the door to a million other truths that are just waiting there eagerly to enter your life experience. And it's
such
a lost opportunity, you know.
It is. So
don't you think we'll just create it again, though? I mean, we'll just draw it in again until we get it, I would assume. I mean,
yes, but maybe not. And this is where we run the risk of doing the same thing over and over again for an entire life or an entire series of lives. We don't necessarily have to get it. And it's important to remind yourself of that, because, you know, it's like, well, if I beat my head against this wall enough, I'm going to finally wake up. Maybe not. Maybe not. That's why you want to get started now and bring this very present attention into these interpersonal situations that are making you uncomfortable, because they are, again, they're perfect. It's hand in glove. And you can find oftentimes with people as they go through a series of relationships that they trade roles. They trade roles with the partner. And, for instance, they might be in one way or another, let's say, victimized by somebody. And they'll go into another relationship and they'll be the victimizer, for instance.
Exactly.
And back and forth it goes. You know, so what we're being groomed by the higher powers here to wake up to this, because we're seeing both sides. But some people don't. They, and it's, again, it's all free will. And, you know, just like in my work with astrology, a lot of people feel that things are pretty much set in stone based on the astrology. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's all free will. You know, you don't, these are, you know, all these things are, is a description of the lessons you've, you know, decided from the level of soul, from the standpoint of soul, to learn in this particular lifetime. Whether or not you show up, pay attention, pass tests, and move on is entirely up to you. Now, that scares me to a certain degree, because salvation, then, is entirely dependent upon our willingness to wake up.
I've gotten myself into a lot
of
trouble.
That's the whole my
being
is my sustenance. Oh, go ahead, Daniel. Sorry, sir.
I've gotten myself into a lot of trouble with astrologers, because oftentimes I'll say in a column or something like that, I'll say, I have a wonder's worth of respect for astrology, but I don't see that the stars create these things for us. All they do is reflect the energies that are in motion. And
True, and they create the stages, Daniel. The rest is up to us.
Mm-hmm. And when we see it, sometimes when we see the reflection, that's all we need. That's all the stimulus we need to change it. And then in the next moment, suddenly things are different. You know, we're in a different universe, in a different place, and there's a different reflection. And it's that's the skill we're learning now. We're hip-hopping from universe to universe, and it's really interesting how it's working.
And it's awareness. It's, you know, because, like, my nanny family right now, I have a family that for the first time, there's a five-year-old and a two-year-old. Normally, when I'm with a five-year-old, my services are complete. I mean, in the last 18 years, I basically take kids from birth to five, and then I'm complete. But for whatever the reason, this family and me are dancing beyond that. And the mom is like, okay, you know, we want to teach Anya, you know, how to be gratitude. And I go, how do you teach gratitude? I mean, like, I can be an example of gratitude. I can put her in certain experiences that might create gratitude. But how do you instill a virtue? And I ask this very honestly and earnestly to both of you, because if you have any suggestions, I'm open.
Daniel, you want to go first?
Well, I do know that one of the biggest things that creates gratitude in me is the deprivation.
Exactly.
I mean,
that's what we came. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, if something gets taken away and suddenly I get it back, I really appreciate that thing.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden, gratitude is a whole new thing. But the question being is that when parents take on the role of being the great potter, forming and fashioning the personality of their children, I wonder about the overly omnipotent attitude that's being displayed there, because that child, you know, as Khalil Gibran said, you know, those children come through you. They're not of you. They're not here for you to form and fashion. They're not going to be little mini-me's for you to create for yourself, you know. So if you're going to say, oh, I think I want to put this quality or that quality into them, I mean, they've got their own journey, and they're going to be doing that thing. They're going to be doing what they need to do on their journey. And if you like gratitude, then show gratitude, you know, in their presence. And if it's sincere, they're going to pick up on it, because they always pick up on sincerity. But I don't know about this idea of being Dr. Frankenstein trying to make my kid by putting together these pieces. You know,
I don't even have an answer for it, because, like I said, I'm so used to dealing with I can tend to a child's basic necessities, meaning as my history, I have that. But when the mother asked me that, I didn't, you know, it did throw me off a little, because I came home and contemplated and go, I don't know if I can teach this. You know, I can be this, but beyond that.
That's the point right there. Daniel nailed it in terms of the sincerity factor. The way to transmit anything is to embody it. It can't just be a theory. And, you know, this whole thing about, you know, do as I say, not as I do, that doesn't work. And any child is going to tune into that. They're going to see whether or not there's integration there. And so in terms of transmitting virtues, well, we have to be careful when we talk about virtues, don't we? This whole thing about gratitude comes, I mean, a strong cofactor to that is humility. And humility engenders gratitude because of just your awareness of where you are in the hierarchy of things and how basically, you know, you're on the same level as everything else. The human ego has a tendency to put the human being above everything else and therefore above the natural presence of gratitude. So this thing, it's like, you know, we're, you know, a lot of the modern, really contemporary paradigms that are about manifestation now talk about how important it is to be in gratitude, right?
Right.
Well, that's true,
right.
But this gratitude is not something you can force or fake. And Daniel's, again, very correct in terms of one of the things that can create true gratitude is deprivation. And all of a sudden, you have a completely new respect for this thing that you're getting. Whenever you go on a fast, for instance, and you know all you've been doing is drinking water and juice for a week, and you start to eat food again, you have a whole new appreciation for that. Every mouthful tastes amazing, and you chew it thoroughly rather than just, you know, swallowing it whole. So that, you know, if you want to again, engender this notion of gratitude, you could always deprive yourself. But the other way of doing that, of course, is to enter into humility and respect for all things. And immediately, your perspective on these things shifts.
Well, and if you also educate and illustrate, like you can make all the children in America so grateful for what we have here by simply taking them on a tour on what some of the other children of the world have to face in their day to day. If you walk through some of these places in Ghana or over in
India,
Africa, and you see the things that these people face, they're going to come back and they're going to look at their McDonald's and they're going to look at their grass they have to mow and they're going to look at the flowers and they're just going to kiss them because they go, gosh, we have so much more than we ever thought. So, in a way, opening up their perspective to what the rest of the world is and what else is out there, that can create gratitude in a big way. And that's, again, you know, you get an opportunity to observe deprivation or experience deprivation, you're going to learn gratitude.
No, it's beautiful. Thank
exactly.
you. Both of your answers. That's beautiful.
Well,
indeed, thank you.
Well, name another virtue. Name another virtue.
Another virtue is respect. Which
okay, is another thing.
Is that a virtue, though? I don't know.
I don't know. Daniel?
Respect. Now I got to go into my Aretha Franklin side. And all I want is just a little Aretha.
And it's funny because these are the conversations I'm having with the parents. And, I'm stumped in the sense of, because the relationship they have with the kids is different than the relationship I have with the kids. What they find disrespectful, I don't. That's why it's like, I don't really know how to answer these thoughts.
Well, you know, that's the other thing is like, you'll never realize how wise your dad was until you have kids.
Right.
And because when those kids approach you, with their needs and their ideas and their judgments, and you can see them, you can see that in their eyes, then you look back on how you approached your dad and you think to yourself, you know, that guy, all he was just a regular guy trying to make it in the world and meet my needs as he was doing it. You know, he was just trying to get by, and here I was expecting him to be some sort of an Olympian god when actually he was just this guy who was had to go to work just like I do and had to come home and, you know, deal with a wife and kids and needs. And you know, and that's the thing is you never forgive your parents so much as when you are a parent yourself.
Well, I agree with that. But in my 45 years, like one of the things I came to an understanding, my father gifted me with going after my passion by being a passionate person, where when I was growing up, I looked at it and said, oh, he just, you know, he's an absentee dad. But what I got as an adult is, well, he lived in his passion.
Correct, yeah. In other words, he didn't place the family as his number one priority. He had
it wasn't
a life.
His passion.
He had
exactly.
Yeah, he lived in his
passion. And I honor that because when I bring those conversations up in the sense of, you know, being like, you know, what are you doing with this radio show? And I'll just look at him and go, I'm doing my passion. He understands that language.
He gets it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it's interesting because, once again, you know, in our society, we have these unspoken, unnegotiated expectations that
right.
if a person is a husband or a wife and they have kids, that they're going to make all that their number one priority. But to tell you the truth, not everybody was born to be the parent and the perfect what do you want to
guardian.
Call it?
Caretaker.
Ozzie and Harriet, you know.
Right.
Not everybody was meant to be that, you know. So that doesn't mean they weren't meant to procreate. And actually, I have a whole show we could do on a different kind of societal concept where we no longer segment ourselves off by families. It's more like a village, and it has much more openness than the expectation of all this little segmented familial thing, but we don't have anywhere near enough time to get into that tonight. But the point being is that everybody displays their particular qualities and traits, and you know, yeah, maybe the kid didn't have a dad who always went to PTA or scouts or something with him, but he might have been the best rocket scientist in the world, and he passed those genes on to you, and that's what he was here for. You know?
Absolutely. And my father, really, he is brilliant. I'm learning now by looking at my dad from the adult point of view, he's an alchemist. I mean,
yeah.
He didn't just pass on the passion. He was an engineer. He would look at things from a dynamic point of view, and it's like, I mean, my father gave me the alchemy trait, not
yeah.
my mom. And when
yeah,
I
right.
got that, it was such a tremendous gratitude that, like, wow, you know, it just opened me up and shifted my whole, how, you know, I looked at my childhood and how I look at him today.
I remember James Taylor, you know, the singer. He was married to Carly Simon, and of course he was on the road a lot, and he had a big problem with drugs at one point in his life. And I remember in reading in his biography, he's one of my favorite singers, and I love nearly everything he does. But, you know, at one point Carly said to him, if you want to stay married and be in this family, you've got to stay home off the road. And I remember it was at that point that he wrote that album. He wrote the songs for that album called Dad Loves His Work. And
right.
he chose to continue to travel and be on the road. He finally got on top of his drug problem, which was, she thought perhaps the only answer to that was to take away his passion. And maybe he just decided, no, I'm gonna choose my own path in the middle here. I'm gonna stay with the work thing. But I never knew that was what the origin of that title was. And then somebody brought it up in a documentary where he said, you know, you lost the right to be my wife when you forced me to choose between you and my passion. How could you ever think that it would even be your place to do that?
Wow, those are strong words. Yeah, but it's a strong verdict. She's trying to. I mean, it's kind of what we've been talking about all night.
Yeah, she was doing the best she could. That was her thing, and you know, I guess you might say I don't blame her for that either, because she was trying to save his life. But what it basically revealed was that their journey was done. So now it was time to take a new journey. And to tell you the truth, everything she wanted him to be, he now is with his newest family. He's got young kids and a wife, and he, you know, I've seen some of his later concerts, and I even saw a television special he did where he put her right up there in the center of the thing and said, without this family and without this woman, I would be nothing. So, you know, he got it, what Carly was trying to say. It just didn't happen during Carly's time, but he finally got it.
It was divine timing.
He got it on his own timing, yeah.
Exactly. We're just about to the top of the hour, but can I invite
you
guys
to come
back?
Subject. we're standing up here looking off the mountain and going, wow, what a view.
So you guys are, I mean, I am really, the man crush is getting bigger and stronger. I mean, these are, you know, we really got a good dance, so hopefully I can Whatever it takes to get you guys back, you up, get you guys back on
well,
the air with me.
You just being you, and you're such a great hostess. That's what gets us back, and it would be very
right,
nice.
Right, Goldie, but you know, but large sums of unmarked bills would work well as if you want to throw that into the mix.
I will see what I can do. I don't.
I forgot. Robert's got his own green advisory.
Robert, I got a joke to show with you. Send me your address. I have a joke for you. So you'll get it and you'll enjoy it thoroughly.
You've got my address. We were sending emails today. You've got it.
It's in those emails. Okay.
Yeah.
I will send a wonderful. You'll chuckle.
Oh,
it'll be a beautiful experience.
By the way, you know, we might want to throw in some websites here. RobertSavella.com.
Yes, yes.
You want to read more of Robert? He's constantly putting some new thoughts out. He's got his own little kingdom over there, which is fun.
And the newsletter is fabulous. Sign up for the newsletter. Robert's newsletter is very on point and on. You know, it's up to date. It's on time.
I'm very excited to have him in my universe telling me new things.
Send me an email through my website, and I will put you on my newsletter list. And it comes out twice a month, and it is actually is absolutely free of astrological terminology and jargon. It is in humanistic terms, and I encourage you to write to me and send me a request for that, and I will respond.
But not completely free of dirty pictures. No, just kidding. Just kidding.
Dirty. There's dirt. There's only dirt. That's the only dirty
dirt on the pictures.
We have. And then there's Daniel too. Daniel at reconnections.net, not .com.
.net. The Danimal. Come see the Danimal. And the StarChildren.com. Thanks so much, Goldie. You're always so nice to be such a hostess to let us come and be with you.
Oh, it's an absolute divine pleasure, and we really. I think we cover things that many people are experiencing, and that is my absolute joy and intention to experience. So thank you both for sharing that.
Thank you, Goldie.
Thank you, Goldie.
All right. Namaste. Have a great day, and I'll talk to everybody next week. Bye.
Bye.
Good night.
Good night.